We are here in Fringe Central in the last week of the Fringe. Staples can be heard in the background as people staple reviews onto flyers. And I'm joined by...
Anders Lee.
Now, Anders, can you tell me about your roots in the Nazi movement of the Second World War?
Well, I am of Norwegian extraction, which surprises a lot of people. They think Anders is a German name.
Doesn't it mean change or different?
It does in German, but people assume that it's a first name in German, which it is not. It's a Scandinavian name. But I am not a Nazi. I'm very opposed to the Nazis.
Fringe Review kind of confirmed that Anders is not a Nazi.
What's Fringe Review's stance, just so I know before we...
We're not fans of Nazis, but we are fans of the really interesting story about how your show comes to be at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how much, I've been learning more about fascism because it's making a comeback in my country, as it is in Germany, and I'm learning now about how the quote-unquote denazification was not really as sufficient as we're taught it was in the U.S. and other places. But... The question was about...
Well, it's really that, I suppose it's... You told me something really intriguing.
Yes.
That your show has a really interesting history in that you wouldn't be here, really, would you, if actually something that is a label and is used at the end of a diagnosis, actually you were telling me had its roots back in Nazi Germany.
Yeah. So Asperger's syndrome, which is actually we don't use in the U.S. anymore. It is still used internationally. But people, often... That term gets thrown around a lot. I think it's an unfortunate term for a lot of reasons. Asperger is, of course, I go into that. That's kind of the stand-up part of my show is about why that's not the optimal term for a neurological condition. But if you look at the history of it, it's had to have Asperger's really meant that you were someone who did not fit in with the Nazi model of learning, the Nazi model of work and nationalism. So it's never been, and autism has never been a medical thing that you can point to. It has no essential quality in someone's brain that makes them autistic. It's not about the size of your medulla oblongata or anything like that. It's about behavior.
Yo, what?
I don't even know if I said it right. That's how little I know about science, but I've been...
But so you, at some point, were diagnosed, and the name was attached to you. That actually has a very questionable history.
Yeah. So I wasn't. I was actually not diagnosed with Asperger's, but my diagnosis was called pervasive developmental disorder, which is something that is part of the autistic spectrum. Now, in the United States, anyway, we consider them the same. So Asperger's, PDD, are now just part of the same umbrella. Autistic spectrum disorder.
Now there's this other Anders as well. I'm going to divide you into two. Okay. There's that part of your life. But then there's another part. I'm sure they meet and they were connected. That is a stand-up comedian, a storyteller, a spoken word guy. How did that happen?
Well, ever since I was a little kid, I just had a knack for getting up in front of people and being an idiot. I was bad at sports, bad at school, so the only thing I could really do growing up was theater and acting. And
I think some people around the table here recognize that in themselves as
well. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're an odd bunch. That gets, being a theater kid could be clinicalized just as easily. Yeah. But I studied acting and theater in school and in high school and in college, and then when I graduated, I just kind of realized I don't have the patience for this. I'm too stubborn to be an actor. The waiting in line for auditions all day didn't really appeal to me to do things that I didn't necessarily have any connection to. So I started doing stand-up, which is ill-advised. I would not suggest that to your listeners, especially if you're living in New York City, which is where I started.
This is not a career suggestion you're bringing out here.
No, not at all. Do not do it. But can't say I regret it, because here I am, stand-up is... similar to acting in a lot of ways. I haven't acted in a while, but I this is actually my second year at the Fringe, and last year I came here to just do stand-up. I was just doing straight joke one, joke two, joke three, and that really didn't resonate with people over here, and I realized that if you're going to build an hour, you need a narrative, you need a through line, you need to know yourself, and so I went back to New York last year and kind of made myself do this because this is a topic that I, and I opened the show by saying this, it's my least favorite topic to talk about.
So one journey is there's this young boy who's showing signs of the fool, you know, the guy, and he grows up into someone that heads through stand-up, storytelling, avoids acting a bit, you know, for good reasons, and spoken word. And then at some point in your life, there's also a label put on you, and you choose at some point to put that into a show.
Yeah, because this is something that, you know, I did, and to this, I really don't know how I identify now, if I identify as autistic or neurotypical. Like, I think...
Well, can we be clear? You have a ginger beard as well.
Yeah, that's something. That's a condition on its own. But for most of my life, especially since I became an adult and moved away from home, this has been something that I haven't told anybody about. I hate, you know, I would avoid conversations when autism would come up. I would just leave the room. Because it's something I was ashamed of.
And where does your stand-up stop and your spoken word start?
Ooh, you mean through the course of the show? Or?
Yeah, but also because in The Fringe, it's quite hard to label some performers, and sometimes they're in the stand-up comedy thing, but it's spoken word, and sometimes the opposite. Are you mixing those together at the moment?
Yeah, I mix them together, so I'll go in and out throughout the thing. I guess, you know, stand-up is very nebulous, very hard to define, as a spoken word is, too. But, you know, the way I was sort of reared in the stand-up tradition is you have a setup, punchline, and a couple tags. And so if I'm telling a traditional joke, that's where I guess the stand-up is. But, you know, as anybody who's seen a few comedy shows at The Fringe, that's not really too apt of a limitation because a lot of people go beyond that. A lot of people do way different things, and it can still be in the category of stand-up. So, I mean, I'm not too picky. Just like with the autism label, I'm not too picky about what people label me as a performer. I'll go with whatever for the purposes of the program. I'm spoken word, but if you want to call me a stand-up, I don't object.
And if someone's listening to this, that's kind of heard those terms used, but there's going to be a show about it, but they're worried about, you know, are we going to laugh at that? Are we going to laugh with him? How do you want people to respond to you and that story? Do you want them just to meet you as somebody without the label? Or is the label very much part of the wish you have for your audience to engage with you?
Well, the label's there whether I want it to be or not, you know? I've had a lot of people... It's funny because half the people I know say, like, if I reveal to them that I got this diagnosis, they'll say, oh, obviously, yeah, I could have told you were autistic a long time ago. The other half say, no way, you're not autistic at all.
Right. So
the label's going to be, but I, you know, I didn't choose this label. It's there. It's something I've grown up with hanging over my head. So,
but are you finding, you know, humor and observation in that people who are not on the spectrum can laugh at? In the same way as if someone on the spectrum was in the audience.
Right. Well, it's can be uncomfortable sometimes because people don't know whether to laugh, which I think adds to the show. It adds a tension.
And that's sort of where it goes into spoken word a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's something I had actually a lot of trepidation about doing this show is because I do make sort of... There is some blue stuff in the show. I talk about the stigma... trying to date as somebody who's labeled as being autistic, how that is not a very appealing thing for a lot of women and men. One of the trepidations I had is that a lot of people have had much, much more severe experiences with these things than I have. So how are they going to feel about it? But I kind of reached the conclusion, like, I can speak for myself, and that's it. And these are thoughts that I have. These are things that are going to resonate with other people. Other people maybe not. But it's okay to laugh if you find something funny, you know?
And as someone then that, you know, researching, and particularly with comedy, it's observational. As a spoken word, you observe the world outside, you observe yourself.
Yeah.
Now you've done that. Do you think you observe the autism in you more than someone that, say, hadn't done stand-up comedy and presented it to other people?
Yeah, well, so one of the stereotypes about people who have been diagnosed with autism is that we can't read social cues. And to be a stand-up, to be a performer, you have to be able to read social cues. You have to be able to feel out the group, the crowd, the audience. But with stand-up, it's interesting because the vibe is determined purely on laughs. So are you getting a lot of laughs? Are you not getting any laughs? But if you're doing something a little deep, if you're doing something that's not stand-up and you're performing, you have to dig a little deeper. You have to see the way people's faces, how they're carrying themselves. I think I'm either have a knack for social cues and that I'm very tuned into it. I don't know if that's natural or if that's something I've learned because I've grown up thinking like, oh, this is something I'm supposed to be really bad at. I have to pay extra attention to people making eye contact. You know, if I'm talking to somebody and they'll start looking somewhere else, right, then I just stop talking and wait for them to meet my eyes again.
So outside, you become more kind of, you have to work a bit harder, you're saying. But in terms of you and your self-knowledge,
yeah,
this is a deliberately naive question because I don't know, and there's a sort of curiosity. Can you observe your own autism in real time?
I observe my behavior, and my behavior is going to be is self-diagnosed. I can't help but think, do I do this because of autism or not? And that's again why I think it, you know, your own autism, that's not a thing. Autism is a construct. It's not, there's nothing that makes a person autistic. It's just a series of behaviors that get grouped that way. So if I, you know, am, so if I'm a mess, because I'm a messy person, I often think like I have, my brain makes me messy because of autism. But you take somebody who's very neat, very organized, scrupulously labels everything and organizes, folds laundry and stuff. That's also a characteristic of autism.
My brain makes me messy because of megalomania, according to some people.
Yeah. Yeah, you can take any behavior and diagnose it with being autistic or being some sort of psycho, you know.
Now, in terms of making the show, is that then, you know, is that your material? Is that a script? Are you allowing yourself to improvise a bit? Do you change the material from show to show?
I have a kind of a base. I mean, we're talking about disorganization. It's all written down in pieces in different places, right, and I know it in my head.
But you've got very clean arms. I can't see Biro, you know, writing.
Really right there.
Okay. Oh, yeah. But you like to experiment with your material.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And that's, I think, one of the things that stand-up has allowed me to do is that, you know, there's no fourth wall. So you get to, and I'm used to that. I'm used to being able to play and talk to people, just divert myself from the script and just kind of have go off the cuff a little bit, which is something that if you're a theater performer, you're trained to not do.
Do you ever lose it? Do you ever corpse on stage and uncontrollable laughter?
Do I ever laugh at myself?
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because when I was an actor, that was a big problem I had because I would always get cast in the comic roles and I couldn't help but laugh at my own comedic genius. But after doing stand-up for many years, you know, you have to deal with a lot of people finding you not funny at all. And so that goes away.
Tell me a joke in Norwegian.
Alakin akachin dakachin maka. That is a joke. I don't remember the exact wording, but there's actually a story. When my grandparents started dating, they're Norwegian-American. They were. They're dead. But my grandfather, when he was meeting my grandmother's family, they had an old Norwegian joke that went like, everybody knows the monkey, but the monkey knows nobody. And they said that in Norwegian around him. They didn't know he knew Norwegian, so he says in Norwegian, how nice to be the monkey.
We've got people laughing here. Jamo helevo hude hundradeo.
No idea what that means.
See? I thought that was Norwegian, but apparently it's Swedish. Finally, in terms of then your decision to come to Edinburgh, what makes you put yourself through this crazy, noisy, uncertain, trying to get audience, maybe not getting audience festival?
So this is my second year here. I came here last year because in New York, when you're a stand-up comic, you don't get much opportunity to do longer sets. And I had a lot of experience doing 5-10 minute spots here and there, but I really wanted to get practice doing an hour. And I had an awful month last year. It was, no one was coming to my shows. I had a girl I was dating stay with me, and we stayed in the living room for 2 weeks and just argued the whole time. It was just a terrible, terrible month. If it had been a little bit better, I wouldn't have been motivated to come back.
Okay, so this is the it can only get better from here, friend.
Exactly. Yes. So it was so bad that the only silver lining was like, well, I need to do it again. So I know what not to do next year, and that's what I'm not doing.
So finally, on these last rainy days, Edinburgh has met our expectations in the last week with rain and lots of people looking around for a show to go to. What would be your invitation for people choosing between those shows to come and see yours?
Well, it's going to make you laugh, it's going to make you think, and there have been a couple occasions where it's made you cry. So if you want a sort of a full-on, multi-emotional, multi-dimensional experience that'll leave you chewing on some questions, then you should come.
Thank you for talking to Fringe Review.
Thank you.